This is Fresh Air. I'm Marty Moss Cohen. Jupiter is taking a beating this week from comet fragments that are crashing onto the face of the planet. These collisions are so large that the marks they leave on Jupiter are visible even to amateur astronomers through their backyard telescopes. Anthony Avini says that human beings have been gazing upwards for thousands of years, looking for answers to questions about the relationship between the cosmos and human behavior. Avini is an archaeoastronomer who's been studying ancient cultures, particularly the Mayans, and how they came to understand the movements of the planets. His book, Conversing with the Planets, is about how early societies, through naked-eye observations, discovered many of the secrets of the universe, and how some of those discoveries help scientists today. Anthony Avini is a professor of astronomy and anthropology at Colgate University. He says the comet crash of this week would be meaningful to cultures thousands of years ago, though for different reasons.
There is a lot of excitement about the comet crashing into Jupiter. There used to be a lot of excitement when comets came into the sky hundreds and thousands of years ago and were first seen by ancient people. Comets were omens. They usually were bad, spelled with four B's and four D's, very bad. It's interesting that under the surface of all the comet hype that's going on this week, there is a negative omen, isn't there? Namely, what if it should strike the Earth?
Right.
What if something like this should take place on the Earth? And I think we're just as eager in anticipation of something happening to us as a result of some phenomenon we see in the sky. So in that sense, there's a parallel. Of course, there are differences.
Well, let's talk a little about the fact that it seemed that the people of many years ago, and you've written about the Mayas and the Babylonians and others of that time, that they looked at the sky because they saw significance there. And I wonder if that isn't something that's different today. We don't look to the sky so much to try to understand what nature is all about.
The difference between us and them, I think, Marty, is that they used the sky for practical purposes. They used it to devise a calendar. How is our calendar made up? Well, it's made of months that are pages, 12 pages to a sheet, weeks, and of course days, which are the most obvious regular periodic occurrence. Ancient people watched the phases of the moon to determine the month. They didn't mark peel off pages of a calendar. Likely, the women in that society used the moon to regulate the menstrual cycle. In fact, there is an obvious connection between the two through evolution. When we come to things like periodic comets and eclipses, which are the really fantastic events, well, they too, many of them can be predicted. And the Maya, for example, wrote a very famous book known as the Dresden Codex, because it turned up in the library in Dresden, Germany, after the Spaniards ripped it off from the natives, which has an eclipse table accurate to the day. And you can still use it to predict eclipses. So the sky was a permanent part of their practical environment. I mean, they used the sky the way you use a computer or a PC.
And you say the Mayas were the cleverest astronomers in the Americas.
Well, I mean, I'm for them, but I think a Babylonianist would argue to the contrary. In Conversing with the Planets, I have a chapter where I talk about one of the cuneiform tablets of the Babylonians, and I compare it with a Maya book with the calendar of Venus that they follow. They seem to be quite fascinated with the planet Venus. They followed it all around the sky. And these two documents, the Babylonian tablet and the Maya book, are almost identical in their prediction. So I think, yes, these New World astronomers were right up there with the Greeks and the Romans and all those guys who gave us our culture, I think.
You said most of the early stargazers watched the horizon. Why?
Well, our astronomers, of course, look up, don't they?
Right.
And we look up with our telescopes probably because it's clearer there. The atmosphere is less hazy. But the horizon line provided a line of demarcation. It pretty much told where objects appeared and disappeared. And the Maya were very concerned about that, about where things came up, where they went down, sacred directions. All over ancient Yucatan, the Mayas aligned a number of their religious buildings with the places where their gods and planetary gods would appear and disappear. And this whole cosmic architecture was a part of their realm. So the horizon is a dividing line between the world below and the world above.
Did the early astronomers use any kinds of instruments?
Well, this is the famous question. Of course, we being so technologically oriented, will say, how could they do it? How could they predict the appearance of Venus to a day, to within a day in 500 years? There is no evidence, Marty, in the archaeological record that they used anything. And that does baffle me. I wish we would dig up some sticks or notch sticks or rulers or something. Apparently, they did it all with either no tech or low tech, and we have to let the archaeological record speak for them here, because if we don't find the evidence that they were using such tools, why, we have to be prepared to devise their science and explain it without them.
I'm curious, and you mentioned the fact that Venus seemed to hold a special place in some of the early cultures. Why Venus, you think?
Well, when we're kids, of course, we all memorize the planets, don't we? Mercury, Venus, Earth, Mars. And we're taught that they're all little tiny round balls that go around the sun. Some, like Jupiter, bigger than others. If you look at the way they behave in the sky, however, they don't all do the same thing. Venus, in particular, always lays very close to the sun. It rises ahead of the sun, portending the arrival of the sun god on Earth. It departs shortly after the sun. You might almost say it rises like a phoenix out of the ashes, if you want to get poetic about it, of the sun. Well, Venus was, for the Maya, the brother of the sun. He was the brother of the sun god who announced his appearance. In the old world, she, a female, was Ishtar, the love goddess, because she descended into the underworld to follow her lover who had been captured by the underworld gods. And then she came back garbed in all of her seven veils. So Venus does something that the other planets don't do. If you follow Jupiter, for example, Jupiter ranges all the way around the sky at night. You can see it high in the midnight sky opposite the sun. Not so Venus. Wherever the sun is, Venus will always be close behind. I think this is interesting because it suggests to us that there are different classifications of nature, different taxonomies, to use a science word, that other cultures might see that we don't. They might slice up the natural world different from us. Apples and oranges might be in the same basket in their world.
Did some of these ancient cultures divide planets into male and female? Venus, of course, having some female attributes. Jupiter, of course, as we understand it today, having more male attributes, whatever that is.
Well, Marty, they were sexists. I mean, these people were sexists. And I've got some passages in Conversing written by the priests and the people, the astrologers. And I have to put the little disclaimer in there that, hey, you know, I didn't write this, guys. This is written by those people. Venus is the only prominent female planetary deity. The others are male, as you might expect, the god of war, the god of justice and equality, Jupiter, the god of the underworld, Saturn, and so on. And I think that this is largely history written by men, and you don't get a lot of women in it. Of course, there's Athena. She may show up as an asteroid, but not as a prominent planet.
Why, though, has Venus been associated with love and fertility?
Well, that's a complex question, and a lot of people have written on it. Pliny, the Roman writer, says that Venus causes the dew on the grass. Now, that's a good reason to see Venus causing the dew, because Venus is always close to the earth, isn't it? Close to the sun after sunset. When the sun goes down, you get dew on the grass. And then when animals rub their genitals over the dew, that's what causes the whole fertility reaction to take place. I think this is kind of a neat, if superstitious, scientific explanation of how Venus, of all things, is connected with fertility. But we have to remember that the relationships between things in nature in the mind of a Roman or a Greek or a Mayan or a Babylonian is just not the same as it is in ours. So there's one reason for Venus being a love deity.
Well, let's talk a little bit about Jupiter, since we're all obsessed with that planet, with all the goings-on up there with the comet crash. What were some of the early beliefs about what Jupiter was all about?
Well, Jupiter has always been one of those kind of middle-of-the-road planets. I mean, it's not the farthest from the sun, and it's not the nearest. It's not the brightest, and it's not the faintest. And in the Greco-Babylonian world, that's why they thought that Jupiter was the god of mediation and justice, because he takes the just and middle position. And that's the appropriate position to be taken by the king of the gods, isn't it? Not the queen, the king. Mm-hmm. But if you're going to be the king of the gods, you've got to be fair and just. You've got to look out after the little guy, and you've got to make sure the big guy doesn't get too out of place. And so Jupiter has that mediatory aspect. Now, in the Maya world, it's interesting that none of these aspects appear. None of these things having to do with connotations having to do with justice appear. There was a king of the ruins of Palenque, I say ruins because the city's been destroyed for 1,500 years, who followed the planet Jupiter and demarcated all the events in his life after the movement of that planet. Nobody knows why. He is said to have been married, to have conceived his children, to have acceded to office, even to have died when Jupiter did something in the sky. Now, of course, I think that's probably history. Revisionist history, because I don't think you can plan your death to coincide, or birth or death to coincide with Jupiter.
Anthony Avini is our guest on Fresh Air today. He's a professor of astronomy and anthropology at Colgate University and author of a book called Conversing with the Planets, How Science and Myth Invented the Cosmos. What was it about planets and planet behavior, you think, that inspired some of these early cultures to create stories? And we were talking earlier about the kind of predictability of nature and looking to nature to understand the future, to understand the present and the past. But it seems that planets also were the seeds that many stories and myths came out of.
Well, Marty, if you look at the sky, of course, you'll see the stars ever present. Scorpio will always be Scorpio. The Big Dipper is always shaped like a dipper, at least for thousands and thousands of years. And the sun will always rise in the east and set in the west, although it'll shift its motion a little bit. The planets do something quite different. They wander. Mm. And in fact, the word planet means wanderer. And there's a debate about the etymology of that word. If you go into detail, some of the Babylonians contend that it means the sheep who escaped from the fold. Well, anything that wanders around the sky on a journey, of course, can be the subject of a marvelous travel myth like the Odyssey or the Iliad. And so these wanderers then who wandered across the sky became counterparts of terrestrial people, the deities. And of course, the gods behave very much the way you and I do. Mm. Some of them were fickle, some of them were strong, some weak, some jealous. And I think then humanity projected all of its doings, all of its wanderings and goings on the sky. The planets travel the zodiacal roadway. They move across the track of 12 constellations, Cancer the Crab, Taurus the Bull, and so on. And as they move from one house to another, perhaps they portend good and bad. When they go from the house of fortune to the house of love, maybe we'll lose all our bucks and fall madly in love. And I think they're wonderful backgrounds, stages, sets, if you want, for enacting stories, for telling fairy tales.
Well, were there all sorts of ceremonies then where we'll say, Mayans or Babylonians or others would come out and watch certain events in the sky?
Well, they would, because the old astrologer's motto is as above, so below. And I think that that means, of course, that whatever happens in nature or in the sky also happens with us here on Earth, and that's the motto of astrology. This is something, a belief that was adhered to all over the world, still is in many parts of the world, and it can be even argued that in newspaper astrology today, people still believe that. I think we waste our time going around condemning it as scientists and saying, no, this is the truth. I think the truth shall be what the people want it to be, and much of it may be wishful thinking, but these stories are wonderful and beautiful. And so it's logical that these stories would be tied to religion, because if you can influence those gods, cajole them, bribe them, con them a little bit by making an offering, why, maybe they would do you a good turn. Maybe the comet wouldn't cause death and deprivation.
Are there certain given scientific principles that we understand today, principles like gravity, that have their roots or their understandings back in some of these early civilizations?
Well, you don't have to have gravity to function and to live in the world, and there are other ways of explaining how things happen. I think a Maya person, if that person could come back, well, yeah. Maya people aren't dead in the first place, they're still alive, but I mean, if an ancient Maya astronomer could come here into the studio and talk with us, he'd probably say something like, well, I don't really give a damn what the center of the universe is. I'm the center of the universe. My culture is the center of the universe. And whether there are these orbits that define what goes around what in some mathematical system is of no consequence to me. Any more consequence than there's a comet falling into Jupiter or there's a spiral galaxy catapulting away from us at hundreds of miles per second. So what? And I think the old flat earthers say, the people who believe in the flat earth, is that as far as I'm concerned, the earth is flat and it doesn't have any impact on my life. Well, we tend to regard that as a kind of narrow-minded statement. But then we have to realize that these other people had different ways of compartmentalizing their knowledge. So gravity, in my mind, becomes kind of irrelevant. Uh-huh. I don't know if I'm making that point well enough for you to get across here, but I think gravity doesn't have to be a part of the picture. You can still live on Earth and function and explain things very well without it.
How many flat earthers are there in the world?
Oh, heavens, I don't know. I'm certainly not a member. I want you to know that.
Well, I understand
not so many. I understand they had a society based in England, and I remember that when the Apollo moon landing took place, they denied that it ever happened. And of course, the flat earthers pretty much stuck to that. But I don't know. Not a large membership, I don't think. Well, they'll probably get calls now.
Well, let's just take a short break. And again, our guest today on Fresh Air is Anthony Avini, and he's a professor of astronomy and anthropology at Colgate University. He's the author of a book called Conversing with the Planets, How Science and Myth Invented the Cosmos. More after a short break. This is Fresh Air. My guest is archaeoastronomer Anthony Avini. Well, I don't want to give the moon short shrift this week because, of course, this is the week that we celebrate the 25th anniversary of the first moonwalk. And I would think that for many cultures that the moon has to have a very central place. Obviously, it's very changeable. Its size in the sky, of course, is bigger than anything else in the night sky. What are some of the early beliefs, ideas about what the moon was all about?
The moon, I think, was one of the most important objects in the sky in devising ancient calendars. And it's a short period, that moon phase cycle, isn't it? You go from new to quarter to full and then back again in a month, 29 days. In fact, the moon calendar, reckoning by months rather than years, was in vogue all over the world, really up to the time of Julius Caesar. It's Julius Caesar who gave us the solar-based calendar of 12 months and a year. It isn't surprising that short duration period would govern time, because isn't it easier to say, well, I'll meet you in a quarter moon from now or one moon from now rather than 0.67 of a year or a certain number of months? There, of course, is the myth of the man in the moon, which is a marvelous myth about the age-old story of the rise to power and the cataclysmic decline. What happens to that man in the moon who we've seen in profile looking like a face on a cameo? You see his curly locks of hair and a medallion around his neck. He's bitten by a dragon who gradually eats him away, and he dies. But, of course, when he dies, he's replaced by his son, who is the new moon, who gradually grows and waxes to brilliant incandescence. But then, just like any great hero, American or otherwise, in the height of his power, he falls and is bitten by the same nemesis who did his dad in. Well, that's a marvelous myth, and it goes all the way around the world. And there are the male and female connotations, of course. Male sun, female moon, and all of the dualities, polarities, complementarities, as the anthropologist would say, in life between men and women are reflected in sun and moon myths.
Let me ask you about what this week has been like for you as scientists and lay people are learning about and watching some of the comet crashes on Jupiter. What's it been like for you?
Well, we have talked about it a lot because it's a big event. To me, it's parallel to the Ranger camera crashing into the moon back in the early 60s, the landing on the moon, all of those marvelous space missions with new imagery. It's only really been in my lifetime and my extent of teaching for some 30 years that all of these things have happened. And it's very, very exciting to see. I think what I reflect on most of all is the kind of impact frenzy we're involved with lately. Catastrophic things that take place. The newspapers talking about the astronomers gleefully watching this impact. Well, I think not because they like bombs and impacts, but because it's exciting. Everybody loves a big bang. In our generation, I think we've been through a lot of cataclysmic ideas in science that have taken place. Look at the genetic alteration of a tomato, for example. With the snap of a finger, you can suddenly change a species. Punctuated equilibrium in evolution. Stories of whole civilizations that can be wiped out by tidal waves and volcanic eruptions. We're a very catastrophe-oriented generation, aren't we? And here comes another great catastrophe. Thank goodness it's not happening to us. And I think that's the real bottom line of all of this. What would happen if it did happen to us? And in that sense, the comet is very much an omen, just the way it was for the ancient Mayas or for the ancient Babylonians.
Let me ask you a personal question about your interest in, I guess, this mix of archaeology or anthropology and astronomy. When did you get interested in astronomy?
Well, it's I'd been teaching at Colgate for a few years, started there very young. And one day some of my students said to me, you know, what we should do, Professor, is to go to Mexico, because there are all these Mexican ruins and there's a lot of astronomy going on there and so on. Well, this was back in the days of the Stonehenge controversy in the 60s, which you may have heard of, that Britain's monument, which was alleged to be an observatory, and there was a lot of controversy about it. And we'd been teaching a January studies term there, one of those one-month terms where a dozen students do one thing with the professor. I don't have to tell you that teaching in the confines of central New York, upstate New York, it's very cold in the winter.
So Mexico sounded very good.
As I put it, escape the vagaries of the New York climate. To make a short story long, we went to Mexico. I took a study group to Mexico. We just fell into a situation wherein we found material that hadn't been studied. Nobody had really looked at Mexican pyramids and the idea that they might be oriented to the sun, the moon, and the planets and the stars. Nobody had really been carrying on extensive studies of Mesoamerican astronomy. And so we did it. We started doing it, and as we did it, we helped develop the field of archaeoastronomy. We taught courses. We wrote books. And my students have always been a part of my work, and they still are. We're still running the program 32 years later in Mexico.
So you weren't the neighborhood kid who had the telescope in his backyard and the
binoculars
around his neck?
Well, I was as a kid. I was one of these six-year-old kids who always wanted to be an astronomer, and it was before the days of astronauts. I was that type of kid, but my goal was to study astronomy, which I did. I studied in Arizona, University of Arizona, Kitt Peak, came to Colgate, bought the telescope and did all of that. And then all of a sudden, I changed my life by getting interested in the ancient stuff. So what I'm really doing now is not so much studying the stars as studying the people who studied stars. And I guess discovering they're not so different.
Well, thank you very much, Anthony Avini, for joining us today on Fresh Air.
Nice to be here.
Anthony Avini is a professor of astronomy and anthropology at Colgate University and the author of Conversing with the Planets. I'm Artie Moscow-Wayne, and this is Fresh Air.